Hello, and thank you for tuning in. I am Anna Miljacki, professor of architecture at MIT and director of the Critical Broadcasting Lab. And on behalf of the Architectural League of New York and the Critical Broadcasting Lab, I welcome you to our architecture podcast series titled, I Would Prefer Not To. I Would Prefer Not To is an oral history project conducted through audio interviews on the topic of perhaps the most important kind of refusal in architects' toolboxes, refusal of the architectural commission. By definition, the topic of refusal stays hidden from public scrutiny and thus also hidden from history. Withdrawals of this kind tend not to leave paper trails and are not easy to examine or learn from, and yet the lessons contained in architects' deliberations about and decisions not to engage are politically relevant and urgent. Decisions to not engage a commission or types of commissions or commissions with certain characteristics inevitably forfeit potential profit, placing other values above it, at least momentarily. I'm talking to Claire Weiss today. Thank you for joining me, Claire.
Thank you, Anna.
Claire Weiss is a founding partner of WXY, a New York firm recognized widely for its community-centered approach to architecture, urban design, and planning. Founded originally by Claire and Mark Yose in 1998, WXY describes itself now as a tight-knit, multidisciplinary think tank that builds. In 2006, they were joined by Lang Pugh, and in 2011 by Adam Lubinsky. The firm was a recipient of the Young Architects Award in 1998, as well as the Emerging Voice Award in 2011, both from the Architectural League of New York. They received the New York State Firm of the Year Award by the American Institute of Architects in 2016, and were recently named as one of the world's most innovative architecture firms in 2019 by Fast Company. Claire is the co-founder of the Design Trust for Public Space. She holds a seat on the Industry Advisory Group for the U.S. Department of State Bureau of Overseas Operations and serves on the board of the Regional Planning Association. She has served on many design juries, serves on boards of a number of nonprofit organizations involved in shaping the built environment, and has lectured widely in academia. WXY team, which now numbers around 50 employees with a wide-ranging set of expertise, has indeed produced work that straddles different disciplines, including strategic regional plans, landscapes, district diversity plans, schools, houses, renovations, kiosks, benches, much of this in New York City and on the East Coast. And just to name a few specifically, they have been involved in reshaping the Battery Park, reimagining the Astor Place, the Brooklyn Navy Yards, the Rockaway Parks, and most recently downtown of Davenport, Iowa, and riverfront of Toledo, Ohio. So Claire, I hope that we will be able to discuss some aspects of WXY's body of work by talking first about your most memorable decision to not engage or to drop a commission, or if that has not happened yet, can you imagine it happening and on what grounds?
So, Anna, this is such a touchy topic, right?
Yes.
in many ways, you have to, I was delving back into my memory, and what I trusted was my first gut reaction. And my first gut reaction brought me to a moment, actually during the pandemic, when we weren't necessarily all in person, but we were thinking deeply about this question of, does one give up an opportunity if the opportunity is unethical? Our perception is unethical. And do you rely on your own gut? Or is maybe the fact that you personally make those decisions is somewhat also suspect, that your singular decision is a problem? So at that moment, we got a call from a large engineering firm. And I had been very involved on a personal level with groups of people in more of the restorative justice community in closing Rikers, and then served on a committee. Also, Rosalie Ginevra of the Architecture League was on the same committee, and that seems such a clear position to me, to close Rikers. Now, of course, there's the other side of it, which is you close something and people then have to decide what they're going to do. And in the case of New York City, this is not a clean decision. And there are many, many firms who are designing and building jails. But in addition to the jails, there's the other parts of incarceration and other parts of the justice system that involved incarceration. And one of them is the sally ports to courthouses. So we got a call about doing this design work, renovating the sally port to a courthouse in Chinatown near our office at the time. And that's when it struck me that it wasn't, if it was up to me alone, that already was a problem. And so we gathered all of the senior people in the office, and I kind of remember this, and created a sort of Zoom meeting to take on this question. That's a sidewalk. It's public space. What's the problem? And it was very interesting. There was really two gatherings of voices. One of them said, this is really about how the public interacts with these vehicles that are bringing people to imprisoned to their sentencing. That's not the same as designing a jail. And then there was the other voices that said, any part of a system you're involved with, you're not in control of the choices being made. And really that was the segment that won out in that discussion, and that's how we made that decision. And I remember there being anger on the part of the engineering firm, because in a lot of ways they didn't understand why in such a economically fragile time that we were refusing work. And since I founded the firm and it's a majority women owned business, they also had other, reasons why they wanted us to do the work. But that strikes me clearly as the most clear case in recent memory. But in a lot of ways, most decisions are less clear than that.
I will ask you a little bit later about the mechanisms by which you expose the whole office to this kind of discussion potentially. But if there's anything that makes sense to share now out of this particular story, we can talk about it.
Well, out of this particular instance, we made a decision that we hadn't, because again, mechanisms of communication were being rethought. We decided that our internal newsletter going forward would actually tell people what pursuits we were considering. Mm-hmm. And so, we're reconsidering that now, but still today, every week, we send out a full firm newsletter that tells people what pursuits we're considering, allowing them to email, the person who's in charge of collecting things, whether they have strong feelings about any of them or know something. So we kind of, that's really was the result of that.
That the newsletter is internal?
Internal.
Okay.
And again, it's internal so that, let's say, they're kind of a very interesting group of people that work at WXY. Many of them have experiences that are divergent from mine. And if they see, corporate office for so-and-so, they may have some strong feelings about why we should or shouldn't spend the time going mm-hmm. after that project. And so that, I know it seems strange to do an internal newsletter of any pursuit that's being seriously considered, but we made a decision to do that based on that conversation.
I'm fascinated by the breadth of work you do. And I saw that on your website, this maybe disciplinary or typological breadth is encompassed by a category you call markets, which includes buildings, open space, infrastructure, interiors, and planning. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about how getting work in these different areas might be different or how it is complementary. And I can keep going on that topic, but maybe I'll tell you what I'm tempted to extrapolate from it. So before you answer, it's something like a position on architecture and its entanglements, which reminds me of a statement that you made in a short video on the Blue Dunes project, in which you said that there is no longer only one issue. The environment is as important as the economy is as important as community. And I saw that in a way, maybe in this collection of things that you're suggesting you are addressing through the work. And so then How do you get work in these different disciplines? Are they complementary? How do you navigate that sort of mechanically almost?
So, you know, there's a number of threads here. One of them is that because WXY is not a corporately led office, we have a lot of flexibility in figuring out how, as a group of people that happen to be led by me and others, but me originally and then others, you're going to take on the idea that you can never do a project in isolation. So let's say, I'll give you an example recently. I love doing private homes as a person, love it. But over the years have been very torn about whether our office and the amount of time and the value of people's time, how it could be, whether it's proper to use that in the service of a single person for ultimately their benefit only, as opposed to, let's say, doing multi-family housing or even duplexes or even co-housing or any of those things, the private home. And so the private home is clearly not an ethical question for our discipline, even if it's an ethical question for me personally. Mm-hmm. And so the way I've reconciled that is that, and again, I love doing private homes, is that I wait for an opportunity where someone whose work I care about is willing to engage in a discussion about that same topic, which is how much materials and how much time and what happens to it after it's gone. And if they're willing to engage in a discussion about the value of dedicating time and materials, then I'm usually interested in working on it. And then I can talk to other people in the office who might equally be interested in working on it. Now, this is a rarity of people who are willing to do this. And one collaborator friend, client in particular, Jessica Helfand, who she's one of the founders of Design Observer, has been a client three times. And we're just finishing up a current loft. And in this case, she was equally willing to, A, to have that discussion, but B, to agree that we would be very hard on ourselves about throwing anything out from a carbon point of view, from an embodied carbon point of view. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be a beautiful loft, but my ethical burdens became her ethical burdens, which was not easy the whole time. So that to me is an example of that scale. Like if you look at our portfolio, there are some single family homes. You have to really dive deep to understand why they're there. Then there's redistricting of a middle school district, for example, D15, in the middle of Brooklyn, that is actually ongoing in a sense because every year there's data about whether the policy decisions are working to mm-hmm. desegregate those middle schools. Are those schools getting better? Are parents happier? Are children happier? Okay, these are intangibles. It's very easy to say why one would take on a project like that, but the hard part is under what circumstances. Do you take on a project like that when you're not sure if you're going to get paid? Do you take on a project like that if you're not sure if the client is going to stay there and you may be left out explaining things that you're not really in a position to explain why you're doing it? And the reason I twin those two scales together, the scale of the private actor that has complete control against working with a massive public system that has rules but may have much, much less control, and that is really kind of the challenge. So the challenge is, it's very clear on one end that that's a project one wants to do, but the factors and the economic, financial circumstances of still working with others and saying, you know, we all have to get paid, we have to pay the rent, like all of those factors weigh in heavily. Less in one case of the private client where fees are clear, payment is clear, or public clients where the circumstances of that, especially on projects that involve highly politicized decisions, can be very fraught.
Maybe it would be useful to talk about how you think of or define engagement in the firm, and in what way, if at all, then WXY presents their point of view or search design in a kind of question or a situation where or context of conversations with different stakeholders. I'm putting words in your mouth, so that may not be how you think engagement. So actually, like, getting a definition of engagement or description of how you go about it might be useful.
So I think that all problems require architects, I'll call us architects, to use design as a process to understand better, and then through understanding better, provide a place for a solution. So sometimes that place for a solution is not changing the built environment, or at least sometimes the answer is not a building. How about that?
I can go with that.
Sometimes the answer is there is a lack of shelter, utilities, systems, et cetera, that do imply building. But getting everyone to contribute to that realization, and I mean everyone really broadly, is a version, at least a version of how we define engagement.
Would you say that you have methods for producing the conversation that that would be adequate for a given question? Or how you sort of ascertain that, what you need, how you set up the table, I guess.
In every project, we have, I'll call it, a kind of checklist to make sure that we're not forgetting all these points of view and perspectives. And then we design a process, and we are free enough to change the process as it's happening. Mm-hmm. So basically, it is like, I call it, this is really the plan. Like, we set up a framework and a plan, and then new circumstances happen, but we're in a good position because of the research and engagement going on, that the changing of the plan of engagement becomes comfortable to people. And so that's really what the idea is. And it's very different. Sometimes the whole purpose is to actually create something that is consensus building, right? But that's not all the reason to engage. Sometimes the engagement is to actually kind of bring forward new ideas that not everyone has to agree with. So I think it's important that both of them can work in projects. Mm-hmm.
So you're suggesting, I mean, I think there are two sort of prongs to this, or two sides to this conversation so far. One is that there is something that sounds like internal discussion within the firm. And I am interested in that. Sort of what are the mechanics of that and structure for that kind of conversation, which sounds like a value conversation internally. And the other sounds like, or the one that I keep trying to kind of get at a little bit, is how sort of getting work across these different scales actually works for the firm.
So getting work for our firm is two modes. Literally public. Some form of project gets posted and you go through piles of paperwork and forms and you just keep at it. And even if the service, let's say in desegregating schools, that you're offering doesn't match the description of the project, what you hope is that when you're in the position to do the project, you can then change the next request for proposal that's going out to conform more with what you think that type of market should be. So it's a kind of market changing approach. The other way of getting work is there's a certain amount of grants that we write. And then there's some work that we get out, like put waste to work, where we do, from work we've done on other projects, we start seeing that there's a problem policy-wise and spatially, and we go put out a thought piece or a white paper in order to kind of position work. Now, we don't always get that work. In the case of the waste to work, I think it was McKinsey that ended up getting the work. But that idea of making your own work is pretty strong at WXY.
I've been studying the WXY's regional thinking and city-wide strategic plans. As I said, I was surprised at the amount of it, which really says more about me than you. But they often look 20 to 30 years into the future, at least. They seem to be commissioned by civic and government agencies. And for someone who grew up in the wake of some major critiques and academic dismantling of master planning, I find these visions optimistic, and I want to maybe check that optimism against your actual experience of doing this work.
We actually avoid the kinds of traditional planning that happens because it pretends to be long-term, but it actually tends to only reflect what everyone has agreed is the usual shared things. Most of the planning we've done has been, I call it ops work, oppositional planning. So the kind of planning that we've done in Westchester has been for the judge that was brought in under a consent decree to make Westchester do affordable housing. Unsuccessful, but that work came from that. The work we did for even East River Blue Way when Adam first started was to put together all of the plans that all the community groups had and come up with a plan. Again, to basically state to the city there was a plan already there. I mean, East Harlem Community Plan was set up as an alternate process to how things were usually done. So in a lot of ways, it may look to people like that is, I'll call it a master plan, but we rarely use the word master plan. Even the Brooklyn Navy Yard, we call that a master planning exercise. East Harlem is a community plan because the word master plan implies something that's fundamentally wrong, that there is central planning, which there isn't. Even with strong planning departments, most people in Canada, the United States, and many other countries, very few cities in America have any form of central planning. There's all sorts of mechanisms of planning, but mechanisms of planning don't mean that communities, companies, individuals are achieving things through planning. And that, I think staying critical of that is really, really important.
I mean, I like your answer, but I also do think that there are certain, like the part that I found optimistic, let me characterize that, is the kind of capacity to produce long-term view on a large scale that even if that is, and maybe that's what you're saying, that it comes off as a set of studies of possibilities, imagining future with different stakeholders, often in opposition to those who are in charge of, in fact, producing the right. the plan.
Oh, I'm optimistic, not about that the future will be 100 years from now, but I think asking the question is really important. I gave a lecture 2 weeks ago to some students in the Cardozo Law School because they wanted me to talk about Penn Station. And I pulled out of the files in something we had done in 2013 for Municipal Arts Society, which was on the 100th anniversary of Grand Central, called The Next 100 Years. And a number of architecture firms, including Foster and KPF and others, were supposed to come up with a vision. And I pulled out the slides from that and realized that, and there was a particularly funny one about like the original Pan Am building and how to kind of reimagine it about and put residential and a kind of holographic aquarium ocean, a holographic ocean in there and new kinds of food halls. And this is before the word food hall existed. And this was before anyone, the pandemic, where people thought you should be living, you know, on top of Grand Central instead of pure office buildings. And so that was 10 years ago. And so I asked these students, I said, which is the more important question, thinking about 10 years from now or thinking about 100 years from now? And I would argue that you have to kind of do both and balance them. And if your answer is the same, 100 years from now, 10 years from now, that in itself tells you something.
Maybe let me get back to that conversation you were having with Bryony and Adam again, because there was a question about preservation or renovation, or simply working with kind of with an already full context. And you said that the physical environment and objects have so much to teach us, and that the field of architecture may be in part engaged in resisting erasure. And I wanted to talk about that, or have you comment on that further, what you mean by it?
Well, I get really emotional about that because so many projects, you know, back to your essential question, are about demolishing buildings to do something new. Recently, we participated in a design build competition, which admittedly, we did what we were told, which was to demolish a Bond Rider building and propose what to do new there. But the whole time I kept thinking, there's something deeply wrong about this, that how do we as architects practice when, yes, surgical removal, reusing parts of buildings, but fundamentally there has got to be a way to grow, add on to, change, but to really value the embodied carbon and all the materials we've already dug up and are sitting there, and also the legacy of how they were thinking at the time. Like, how was Don Ryder and Max Bond thinking about this community building in the middle of Brownsville? Like, there are things about how they did the stairs and how they did the porch. Like, wouldn't we want to keep those? Why do we have to demolish it, even if it's a city policy, even if it's too expensive? And I think many of our clients are struggling with that. And it's not just up to architects to decide. It's a larger social question. But I think if more architects became activists for the buildings that are already there, and I'm not using the word preservation, I'm just saying activists for those buildings, it would be a huge contribution to the material culture of architecture. I mean, take apart a wall, it's fascinating, especially a wall in an old building, and then try and put it back together.
Mm-hmm. I hear you, and in that conversation also, I heard you in a way advocating for knowledge that's embedded in the built environment.
I'm more interested, imagine like a book, you know, like a book. I feel like the material culture of architecture is really complex. All the decisions people made about how they did things were, many of them are reviving now. Some of them are lost. If you go, one of the buildings I think is unbelievably fascinating, and ARO did a fabulous job with this, which is Donald Judd's kind of studio and living building. And if you look at the technology of the glass, these glass discs in the sidewalk, the little edge, like literally 10 inches off the sidewalk, and you go down into those sub-basement spaces and you see the amount of natural refracted light, and you go back up again and you start looking at the culture that needed and wanted to put natural light into this manufacturing building, even in the depths, and what were they up to, and how they, what they were making at such speed, and where was technology, and what was it like to work there? I mean, I just think it's amazing.
I'm trying to think what's the next good segue out of that, because I have questions about information that come out of some of the things that I was reading, and now we're talking about, in a way, information in the built environment. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the kind of status of data, stories, research, personal, and also in sort of personal stories and research stories that are in the work, and the modes of representation that you use in the firm to enable, let's say, engagement perhaps, or further the work. But also in conjunction to something that you described in an earlier interview I was listening to, in which you talked about the digital world and the way that data might be used to manipulate, and the way in which your interlocutors are often or increasingly aware of that, and thus even skeptical sometimes. And it sounded to me like then you were also saying that architects had a special role in helping navigate that world saturated with data. So maybe there's also this other kind of knowledge in this question, but it's more about how you, again, sort of navigate the processes by which, or help others navigate processes that involve research and data and understanding those and the way that they describe the built environment.
I think there's definitely a dedication to information graphics, I'll call it. But before information graphics happen, you know, is this a pie chart? Is this what colors do you use? How do you name things? Is actually sorting through trends that you see in the information, like things that repeat, that is finding those patterns. And I think as architects, that's really the spatial implications of data, is looking over time, but also what are patterns that no one talks about that are in information about school choice, information about zoning, you know, why do so many buildings of a certain type happen? Why are those buildings happening there? Why are so many people moving, let's say, to a place that has no transit? Like, all of the kind of getting into that offers an opportunity to present information in a way that isn't being discussed, let's say, by journalists, but could be used by people to make better decisions.
Mm-hmm. You know, I printed out a list of your clients to try to make sense of any patterns in it.
Mm-hmm. See, yeah. We're totally on the same wavelength.
Or at least to try.
What'd you come up with?
I wanted to at least try to articulate a question that might be useful. And so the question is, maybe, are there any categories of clients that you prefer not to engage, or that you have historically not engaged, or, you know, conversely, that you prefer to engage? But first, the question of sort of like, who is not on the list in your estimation? Mm.
I think very large scale national developers are not on that list. And it's not that we haven't engaged with them. It's that in general, the kinds of projects they would engage us for do involve more complex sites and issues. But in a lot of ways, those projects don't happen as often, right? So it's really much more the normative. There's already a model for development. The market already recognizes, you know, let's do this kind of thing. And our firm is not well known for kind of market-based typological work. Or maybe, you know, that's not where people see us being.
And certainly not where the effort is in a way in the current portfolio. Right. But this is where, you know, like the effort seems to be, or at least the clients that seem to float up or produce the largest part of it is, you know, government, community, and institutions. And so for me, again, you know, it's curious to think about how, partly because, you know, I'm interested in talking about some of the kind of mechanics that enable practices to operate. So for me, it's interesting, again, to think about how these beget more projects, like how working with a set of clients like this begets more projects in that same realm, and the extent to which that involves personal relationships or projects that sort of multiply.
Well, I have the same question too, but in a lot of ways, unique projects don't get repeated. Casey Jones, who's at Perkins & Will now and was the head of the Overseas Bureau of Architecture for some time, I quote him on this because he said that if you do a same architect and you get them to do, you select them for a project, the first they bring the most to it the first time, but they make the most mistakes. The second time, you get a great project because they've learned from the mistakes, but they still are, you know, of the projects of the same type. The third time, it becomes rote and it's not as good as the project of the second time. And that's always struck with me because for the practice as well, I think there's a huge learning curve, but enthusiasm on taking on a new problem. And then the second time you get to do a factory, an affordable housing building, a pavilion. And, you know, some we haven't gotten to do sea glass again. We have not gotten to do the salt shed again or a farm on top of a convention center. But let's say we would be able to do those for the second time. I'm absolutely sure that they would be a wonderful experience because there would be new inputs, but you'd have a wealth of knowledge. So I think the problem is the kind of projects that people are attracted to us, we're attracted to, or that in a way we have many projects that were not an exciting project. They were just a roof. And the forte was to, as architects, turn it into something. But if that's the genesis of the project, it's very hard to find other projects where you have the opportunity to go from a re-roofing job to a public plaza, right? Like it doesn't always happen. So in a lot of ways, I think most firms, I could be wrong. I have got to read, I'm sure there are good books about this. There are successor firms where you're using the portfolio of a much longer standing firm and turning it into something. This is not the case of WXY, where it was basically thought up and generated off a set of
not yet
ideas about public space, not yet. And then there's networks people have, which are important from going to school, from not going to school, from living in a certain country, and those opportunities are very fluid. And I think that most firms, like ours too, there are networks and opportunities. There are growing the network. Like I really feel that helping other architects, helping younger architects with their firm, giving is actually beneficial to practice. It's not direct, but it's beneficial. Because the more people practicing architecture in a way that connects to both ideas and environmental goals, really, that actually will be, the more people out there doing that, that the market will be using more people because there are less people who are not practicing that way.
Sounds like a better world is better for all, or when everyone is better off, we're all better off.
Yeah, but I think it takes an effort. So there's getting work, but there's also, I would say, helping others work. Yeah. And a lot of our urban design work is actually about creating projects that go beyond the projects we will do ourselves. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe it would be useful to say something about the particular kind of client type of work that for me sort of jumps out of the portfolio that I've seen, which is the schools, and including the kind of district plan or that you've done. But that seems like one that you've done more than two of, or interventions at least in that realm. So,
well, definitely on the planning side, but on the designing a school side, on the architecture side, only three, and about to be four. We're mm-hmm. hope to be in construction mm-hmm. of a fourth. Favorite projects, because they're about education, and really like education for the built environment is really the only hope for change. Mm-hmm.
So is this a kind of context in which when you get to the level of architecture, you sort of imagine architecture participating in that educational project of the new subjects, right? I mean, kids.
Yes, I think that, kids, adults, education-wise, high school students, the idea that we still have a social goal to educate together, not just by ourselves, this is a really valuable thing in a lot of ways. I think it's going to take a lot of work to actually engage more people in this. And I think one thing I'm really passionate about right now is thinking about how to change the way we look at schools. I think if we don't change the way we look at the architecture of schools, people may not ever want to go back to school, and they may not have to go back to school in light of technology. And I think really questioning why we ever came up with a corridor as even an appropriate educational environment is hugely important. So a lot of where I think commissions, clients work, I hope will come is really... And really building on the work of thinking about how do I choose a school? How do I live in a community? What is public education? Is to try and help get school buildings to a different place.
I have now several questions left, and we've all arrived at maybe time. So let me give you the first one, and then we'll see what we do with the others. But this is a bigger one, sort of how do you think of your services or contribution as architecture, as production of effects in the world, as collaborations directed at specific outcomes? And maybe this is a question both about scope and about the nature of authorship in WXY and its engagements.
I think when it comes to authorship, there's sort of two sides, which is taking responsibility for getting things done in a way that one could call it architecturally, that you could even call it architecture, right? And that in itself takes a huge amount of effort. I think key to answering that question is who takes responsibility. And generally, it's whose name's on the door, but it doesn't mean that you aren't working with people, colleagues, consultant colleagues, clients who are taking different kinds of responsibility. I think the acknowledgement that architecture comes out of shared responsibility that can never be credited to one person sort of is critical to what I hope WXY we operate as a firm. On the other hand, I think it's important that if you're the principal and your initial is on the front door, that you acknowledge that you should be blamed for things that don't achieve the shared goals of people. And that is should weigh in to some of the decisions mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. what work you take or mm-hmm. not.
Maybe this is a good moment to recover that question about do you have any procedures in place by which you both expose the office to the realities of running the office, and do you invite the team to think collectively about the commissions that you will and will not take?
So based on the first story about the Sallyport, you know, designing a Sallyport, we absolutely have a shared process of evaluating what to go after. Sometimes that evolves into putting ourselves on a diet of going after less things. So some of it is not ethical. A lot of it is how do we balance wanting to have a more in the black or more profitable business so that we can do things, invest in things more against basically being exhausted and having to work hours that are not appropriate. So like that's really, it's the amount of stuff tends to be the big decision-making. We've really focused on, at least on identifying senior leadership and for people really understanding that the fees are theirs to use in conjunction, collaborating with others, but that clients have limits on fees for all sorts of reasons. So you have to figure out how to kind of put yourself on the right design process and diet. You can't just change your mind at the end. You have to find ways to change your mind throughout. So that I think that we have pretty much a very transparent process about fees and what's getting paid and how much goes to salaries and how much goes to rent and all that stuff. I mean, some people don't want to be burdened with it, but it's theirs. And equally, and we're republishing them all the time, we have a very clear salary bands, what that means and where you could go. And it's a work in progress.
I'm wondering, to the earlier question, if the criteria for the work that you take and pursue or don't take have changed over the course of the sort of lifespan of the firm. And what is the major kind of factor in that change? I'm assuming that they have, sorry. Well, maybe you'll say no.
Well, I feel that number one, we've never practiced, I think that that whole lawsuit happened before my time, I could be wrong, but in public work, there was fee charts and fee curves for a long time, and audited hourly rates. But in a lot of ways, firms have benefited. We've never really benefited because we worked on very public infrastructure projects.
From the deregulation.
We've never really benefited from what happens is that if you have a set fee and you pay less or people get paid less and they do more hours, you get paid the same amount. Not our work isn't really in that category. I don't know how to explain this, but all of our work is by the hour for certain public authorities, and other fixed fee amounts are still highly regulated, as in you have to show actual salary hours.
Yeah, I think this is a bigger sort of discipline conversation. And my sense is that I think the younger architects actually will take us there, back there maybe. But my question to you is for the WXY and whether you could say when you think now, you know, from 1998 to now, have you changed your the set of criteria that you use when you think about what projects to take on and what projects not to take on? At the very least, in terms of sort of your firm's stability.
I think we were willing, when especially when we were in a tiny group of people, to take on projects that we'd never done before for very, very little money. And part of it, you know, yes, I had a practice where it was in our loft. So you basically, and I had a teaching, you know, I would teach more often, so I wouldn't take a salary. And these are all things you hear from architects starting practices. But reasonably quickly, I decided that wasn't sustainable. So you have to find the kind of work. Maybe just takes, maybe doing reports and doing planning is also a way to write and a little bit easier than doing someone's kitchen or doing other things that maybe one might do to keep things going. And not to judge one way or the other, but you always have to find some things that are not time consuming in the same way that drawing and design of a new a building that hasn't been done before is time consuming in a way that is very different than doing planning research. And I think that the idea of a practice that these tasks are complementary, I think has really helped the financial stability of the firm, but it also has helped the organizational stability of the firm. And I think practice as an organization, I think I've always felt that architecture firms at practicing at the scale we do and many other architects do are a little bit like having an arts organization. And they go through periods and they get geared up for performances and there, but I think we are kinds of arts organizations, which means we need to, the people working together need to be healthy and we need to stay healthy. And that means you go through different periods of assessing how is the organization making good on its mission and goals? And it's not easy. It's a struggle to be a small arts organization, but I think architecture firms, in a sense, are holding that same potential.
That's great. I'm going to combine the last two questions together, and then we can pull out. But they are basically, did you ever regret taking a commission? And is there a condition in which you do your best work, or is there an ideal? How would you describe the ideal commission?
I'm going to start with the ideal commission. The ideal commission is a passionate client that has real needs, has a network, and has site control, I'll call it. Now, site control, broadly conceived, it could be a district, it could be a building, it could be a landscape, it could be a... Those ingredients are super important. And therefore, the definition is that a hospital, is that a affordable housing building, is that a factory, is that a paper warehouse? All of those are wonderful commissions if those other factors are there. But finding a passionate client that feels responsible to themselves, the community, the planet, and has site control, and has kind of the interest in a design process, very challenging. So those are few and far between. And so that's the dream commission. Most projects we've done have had very, very difficult moments. all of them. Like, if you asked me at a certain moment, you know, when we were trying to get Sea Glass built, and there was the best, you know, there was no way to get a contractor and to not split the contracts into Wixlaw, which we have in New York, which is every contractor acting independently and no one coordinating. And this is a building that, and a mechanism that had never been done before, you know, extremely low moment. And at that moment, it was like, why did we come up with this idea? And why did we agree to do this? And now that, you know, the other day, Jasmeet Singh, an architect in San Francisco who has a 10-year-old son, dropped by the office. I hadn't seen him in 2 decades. And said his 10-year-old son would not get off the sea glass, and he wants to be a marine biologist. And he found it not only calming, but it gave him ideas. So that it's those moments that are worth it. In most cases, projects that are not meant to be are less because we decided to take them or not take them. But what you regret is putting in the effort for something that the circumstances or even the client team, the implementers, weren't necessarily doing it for the right reasons. So I always look out for being requested to do something where the firm asking you, could be another firm, the client asking you is not motivated by some of the same goals. So that's really a critical. And we do say no if it's very clear that there isn't a shared idea of why we're doing it.
Well, this is a perfect place to end, I think. So, Claire, thank you very much for talking to me today. And listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of I Would Prefer Not To.